Hi and welcome to the Dabuti podcast. It's been well over a year since I released anything because other projects and the messiness of life have got in the way. It gives me a real pleasure to have a Gibraltarian poet and musician, Gabriel Moreno, joining me on the line from London. Gabriel has published numerous poetry books in English and Spanish and has had a busy and varied music career, touring across the UK, Ireland and Europe. His latest poetry book, Heart Mortally Wounded by Six Strings, was released earlier this year. Hi, Gabriel. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hi, Giordano. How are you?
Yeah, not
great
too bad.
To be talking to you in this mad Gibraltarian new renaissance of literature and music.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to be covering a bit later on in the podcast. I want to start off, Gabriel, just by, can you explain to me how you first got into poetry? I mean, I have memories of you walking around Bayside with your long hair and baggy shirts, and I think we had a sense that you were writing lyrics, playing the guitar. What point did that turn into the writing of poems?
Yeah, as you say, it started mostly with lyric writing, in the example of the great grunge writers which we were all obsessed with, like Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder, who seemed to be expressing themselves with a new language which was a tiny bit more poetic than previous glam rock artists. And we found that their words for me were very dreamy and very very exotic, very mysterious. So I think through their words, I started to resonate more with poetry itself. And through the work of Kurt Cobain and Eddie Vedder, I then started to read T.S. Eliot with a different perspective. But it was only until I went to Latin America, that was 1998, when I went to Chile, and I discovered the work of Pablo Neruda, that I started writing poetry completely and totally devoted to the word itself without the music. So yeah, it was in Chile that I found my poetical conversion, as we can call it.
Yeah, and it's funny because I can relate to that, the way that you came into poetry via looking at lyrics. Because I remember listening to, especially in the late 90s, The Doors a lot. And, you know, Jim Morrison's lyrics are crazy and surreal, and it was music where you had to listen to the lyrics. Apart from enjoying the music, which is very good, you had to listen to the lyrics and pay attention to them and try and make sense of them. And that approach was very similar to what you had to do with poetry as well. So even though I was already reading poetry before that, it was the music, the poetry of lyrics that also appealed to me and was another channel into this sort of life. So it's interesting that we've both got that similar path that we took, no? And in fact, the next question I want to ask you is the connection between your musical career and your poetry career, because anyone who listens to your music, and I really recommend going on Spotify or any other sites or watching you perform on YouTube or buying an album off you directly, I really recommend people who haven't heard your music yet to just, you know, to go out there and to listen to it, because it's definitely worth listening to, and it works on many levels. And the thing that strikes me most, and many people who have encountered your music, is that your lyrics are very poetic, and they could stand alone as poems, I think. So how do you, my interest is in finding out how you draw the line between good lyrics and good poetry that you're willing to see published, for example. What makes one set of verses lyrics that you sing in a bar somewhere, and another set of verses ones that you print in a book?
Yeah, well, in our tradition, like you said before, the troubadour was something that kind of like mixed the music and the poetry, even when it was poetry without actual instruments, because there's a great musicality to the poems that I started to read at first. But I decided from a very early age that I had to separate completely the two processes. The only way they can filter each other is through the use of similar images or similar metaphors. But in terms of the writing, I always know when it's going to be either a song or a poem. I start the lyrics completely based on music of a song, completely based on chords, completely based on melody, and then adapt this melody to words. Whilst when I'm writing poetry, it is solely and utterly based on the words in themselves and what I want to do with them, how I want to mold them, how I want to shape them. So I've always tried to keep them completely separate. I had a very difficult experience because I love Leonard Cohen with all my heart, but sometimes his poetry itself, I couldn't feel the same level of love towards it. And I felt that in his work, the music and the poems were more merged than perhaps I would have liked to.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, I tried completely to separate the process so that, let's say that a poem would never be able to be adapted to music because it had its own music.
Yeah.
Whilst lyrics, even if they might work on the page, they might work as an aborted poem or as the possible shape of a poem rather like the final poem, no? Because in the lyrics, you're always really conditioned by the music that you're going to associate it with, no? Obviously, some people prefer to merge the two disciplines and to write poetry which will be adapted to music or vice versa, but I like to keep it separate. And I always know when I'm writing, I always know I'm sitting down to write poetry or lyrics.
Yeah, I mean that's very interesting to see what's going on there, the choices that you're making before anything gets written, whether you already have the chords in your mind or the shape of the song, and then on the other hand, maybe the other things that are driving the
dying poets, Giordano, dying Gibraltarian poets.
So maybe we could edit that out. So we'll start from now. Yes, Gabriel, it's very interesting the way you describe the thought processes there and the amount of planning that's involved, you know, whether, as you say, it's driven more by chords, the tune you have in mind or the shape of the song, and then on the other hand, maybe the metaphors or the feelings that you want to do justice to in your poems. The other choices that I'm really interested in when it comes to Gibraltarian poets or Gibraltarian bilingual poets and writers is your language choices. And you've published in English and in Spanish, and you've also published poems that are Llanito poems because they mix both languages quite fluidly, sometimes from one line to another, or you have the title in Spanish and then the body of the poem in English. We're seeing, as you know, a renaissance in interest in Llanito and bilingualism, and of course calls to save this declining form of expression as Gibraltar shifts inexorably, it seems, towards monolingualism. I'm interested to find out what role Llanito in particular, not just the Spanish language, which obviously you encountered, grew up with, and then encountered again in South America, well, what role Llanito itself has played in your work and in your inspiration?
Well, Llanito in itself started to really play a big role when I realized that it had its own music. And that was probably when I started my solo career as a singer in 2006, more or less. Then I realized that to have my own voice, I could not have the English pronunciation in singing, nor the Spanish pronunciation in Spanish. And I realized that the only language that I felt comfortable with was Llanito, but not only the words, the musicality, the intonation, the cadences of the language, which were something very particular that I could not find, and I could not express myself in other cultures and in other languages. So I think what I tried to do was use the Llanito cadences, the music of Llanito, to instruct me in how to sing and how to become a Gibraltarian folk artist in a way, because I thought the only way to be different is to be completely yourself, and I could not sing any other way. Then I would have been like a pastiche of some other culture or a fraudster or something like that. So I think Llanito completely shaped my voice as a singer. Then as a poet, I realized that I had been taking a lot of influences from the Spanish language and from Spanish literature and from English literature. But when I recited poetry, it was very peculiar that I could not recite poetry with a Spanish accent. It found it very difficult. Even if the words were like Castellano, I found myself like being a bit of a fraudster or a clown by reciting the poetry with a very strong Spanish accent. So I went into Llanito to try and find my voice as a performer as well. And then following that, I went back to writing into English, and I realized that there were certain expressions and certain modes that I could not say in English. So I tried to use Llanito there to kind of I've always used Gibraltarian and Llanito as a way of finding myself, no? Because everything else feels false And I feel like a fraud when I'm trying to be an English poet or a Spanish poet. And when I speak in Janito or when I use the Janito musicality, I feel more myself and I feel more honest as a writer.
And it's bizarre that for many years we've seen this prejudice that Janito is just a language of the street, something convenient that we've had to communicate amongst ourselves, but you can't do anything more with it. It can't go into the wider world or let alone serve as the language of a sonnet or, you know, or a love song, for example. But I think your work and Jonathan Dumas as well, Mark Sanchez as well, and Humbert Hernandez, no? That's yeah, that's totally refuted that prejudice. I think it can definitely serve. As you say, it's if it's authentically your language, if that's a language that you're expressing yourself in, you can write poetry in that. I think the tools are there. It's up to you what to do with them. The same way that you could use the most correct form of Queen's English to say something worthless, you know, you can use the Janito language to say things that are memorable. That express feeling, you know, that have that integrity about them. So yes, I think that, you know, definitely a fresher way of looking at language as a tool and what we can do with these great resources. And that takes me on to my next thing I want to talk about, which is Gibraltar literature or Gibraltarian literature. Is there anything in particular that characterizes it? I mean, if someone were to ask you, like I am now, what are its main features? Could you say anything concrete?
Yes, well, looking at your work and the work of Mark Sanchez and Humbert and Jonathan and another poets, what's clear is that Gibraltarian identity in literature is kind of dancing or moving in this liminal space, no? Liminal space between languages, between realities, and with a sense of discovery. No, I think what really marks us all is a will to discover oneself through literature and through poetry. I think the work of Jonathan and yourself and Mark were always kind of like having an ironic twist at our own minds and thinking back, like, who are we and how can we discover ourselves? And these questions are all in our poems and in our writing, and obviously it comes within different languages, within the Spanish language, within Janito, but not only the languages, the cultures, no? We are all like really, in a way, shocked that we are the offspring of such different empires, no? The Spanish Empire, the English Empire, we have Africa just 17 kilometers in front of us. We have the influence of Italy, of so many cultures, no? And I think we're all kind of shocked that we have had an awakening and realized that we're just we have so many pieces that make up our psyche, and we're trying to discover them. Now is a great time because there are a lot of people who are actually in research through art of this identity and this weird sense of self, which we're all exploring together. I think it's a renaissance in Gibraltarian literature. I don't think we've had anything like that in the past, where like a group of poets, writers, academics are actually on the same road of discovery. And I think we should make the most of this moment for sure.
And I think it's this is definitely seen in your poetry, where there's a spirit of Gibraltar, to take the title of one of your poems, there's a spirit of Gibraltar that permeates it. But that doesn't mean it's limiting in any sense. I mean, you're not writing about the few square miles.
No.
Make up Gibraltar. Gibraltar's like the launching pad for all these other reflections, as you say, about empire, about language, about how language affects your identity, about the absurdity of coming from all these different backgrounds, the absurdity of things in Gibraltar, you know, the maybe the post-colonial attitudes that we still hold. It's definitely a funny place to come from and to grow up in. And that can be very fruitful ground, I think, for poems, for novels, as we've seen in Mark Sanchez's work. And there's definitely nothing limiting about it. I would venture that you could spend your whole life writing poems and stories just about one housing estate in Gibraltar, if you were that way inclined. And there would still be enough there, because it connects with things that are of universal interest. I mean, human beings growing up together, and, you know, encountering the challenges of adolescence, getting a job, losing a job, drinking. I mean, all the things that are sort of appear in our poems here and there, but it could be, it sometimes they're things that could only happen in Gibraltar, but they are also things that happen everywhere and anywhere. So yeah, in that sense, it's the universal and the local brought together.
Absolutely. I've always thought in what I've been taught as well in when I was studying in Barcelona and in Latin America, the thing that I got most from my teachers was that in order to be universal, you have to be incredibly specific. And there's nothing more specific than Gibraltar because it's just a tiny speck of land in the bottom of Europe, you know, just a couple, just on the gateways of Africa. And it's like, it's so specific, so small that if we actually penetrate it completely, we could be a very important example for universal practices of literature and humanity. I know it sounds far-fetched, but any place in the world is as good as any other. No? And if we can analyze ourselves with humility as well, what we can't do, and I think luckily none of us are in that path of praising or exalting Gibraltarian identity or like having this crazy pride about place, because Gibraltar is like any other place in any other part of the world, just a small town full of small-minded people like everywhere. But like everywhere, the more you discover, the more you can understand where you come from, who you are, and perhaps create something positive from that. At least from literature, we definitely have, like you say, incredible material for creation, because we have the clashing of different cultures, the fall of empire. We have also a very crumbling moment in the psychology of human history, you know, the debacle of the 20th century modern man, and obviously the destruction of gender, all these things that we have seen in our lifetimes, mixed with the cultural implications of being in a post-colonial overseas territory. The language is incredible, because if language is the way of looking at life, and we have like two or three languages revolving around us, we have different ways of looking at life and philosophy. I know this sounds incredibly mad, you know, I like to say quite fiery comments, but I think Gibraltar is the perfect place to be a poet. It's absolutely perfect, because poetry is all about longing, and we have this crazy idea that we don't really have a country, because our paternal country is so far away in England. Our maternal country considered us traitors, and we don't really want to be part of Spain. We have Africa, which is there, but we can't really reach it. So I think we're full of longing, we're full of stories, and we're full of complexities. That's the perfect place for poetry, in my opinion.
I think another thing that makes Gibraltarian literature so exciting is that it's becoming the vehicle for a critique of society. You know, there are those underlying assumptions that govern Gibraltarian life, whether it's deference to the British or colonial attitudes that persist, a chupaculismo, no, which governs a lot of public life here in Gibraltar. Literature is the perfect way to unmask all that, to bring it out into the open, primarily because it gives you a defense. I mean, you can always say, no, it's solamente un story de un chupaculo. I'm not saying that everyone here is a chupaculo, but you can expose it in that roundabout way, you know, and it's even more lasting than a newspaper article or an opinion piece or a comment on social media. No, you've given it a more lasting form than that. And what you say about longing is totally, totally true. I think longing is a condition of the Gibraltarian soul. Longing and nostalgia, no? We're always flung back into our past as well, which might have something to do with the fact that Gibraltar is changing so rapidly. I mean, the Gibraltar of our, even the days I was referencing before when you had your long hair in Bayside, I mean, those days are gone. I mean, they're not just 20 years ago. They feel like another era, you know, a totally different era. So I find that a lot of Gibraltar literature is nostalgic, you know, always going past to was probably mistakenly seen as a golden age, but it seems that way now to our memory, the memory that's filtered through the present, you know, the 80s, the 90s, you know, it's memory edits out all sorts of things and rose tints things, but it's been very, very fertile ground for literature. So yeah, memory, longing, nostalgia. It's
longing, also abandonment. No, the abandonment that we feel from England. No, yeah, they say that they want to protect us always, and that we are loyal. They are loyal to our cause, but really, no one really cares about England. No, Gibraltar. Sorry, when you go to England, no one really knows where it is. Everyone thinks it should be Spanish in the left, and everyone in the right just treats it like another colonial outpost. And I feel, yeah, the abandonment of both empires. No, Spain obviously didn't even consider us as a people. No? I think that we're just like renegade Spaniards. So yeah, that abandonment, that longing, that also that protest. No, that protest of feeling so small. And, oh yeah, that's what I wanted to say. I forgot. Is the idea of always being an underdog. No, such a small little speck of nothingness, surrounded by the vast ocean of the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, Africa, Europe, and we just felt like completely like a little underdog speck, no? And this is in our consciousness, and it makes us also want to be bigger than we are. And that's not a bad thing. We're always punching above our weight, no? In Gibraltar, that's why we've got great musicians, great poets, great people in a way, because we're doing more than we should, really, considering the size of our little nation. No? So yeah, all this for me is like perfect for a melting pot for literature, for stories, like you say. What I don't like is, like Mark was saying, just to only rescue the stories of empire, no? The stories of the siege, the stories of the military. Those stories are not ours. Those are the stories of our oppressors. No? We need to recapture the stories.
Been overdone.
They've overdone as well. Oh, yeah. They are part of our history. Oh. But first of all, they weren't our stories, because they were the stories of the people who controlled us. And second of, it's already done. And third of all, like you say, the 90s, we already have to redress and recover these periods which are not far in the past, but they are leaving us. And if we don't redress these stories, they will disappear, and we will lose part of our real heritage, which was our infancy as Gibraltarians. I think it's the 20th century, no? The 19th century, we were still conceiving ourselves as people. No? What do you think?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's, I mean, the emergence of a people with its voice, its language, its conceived destiny, its perceived destiny. These are all things that are worth writing about, particularly from a fictional or poetic perspective, because the historical perspective leaves a lot out. It leaves out what it felt like to be a person then, what it felt like to be in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. History will leave that out because of the kind of discipline it is. And if we're not writing these things down, a lot of what marked that time will simply disappear. Because, yeah. I mean, the patio life that's captured by Humbert Hernandez, the smuggling years captured by Mark Sanchez, history books are never going to look at that. They're never going to talk about what it felt like to get on a speedboat and cross the strait to come back laden with, you know, 500 kilos of cannabis. It will be mentioned that those things went on, but it won't capture the lived experience of that. And that is important because you put yourself in the shoes of the person who was doing that. You understand a bit more about where we're coming from. You understand the traces of that are still left in Gibraltarian life. And history is good for many things, but it will leave that particular aspect out. And that aspect is what's most exciting to me as a writer and to you, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in the people. No, I'm not interested in nations. Nations, for me, I hate flags. I do hate flags. I even hate the Gibraltarian flag. I just want to put that out there clearly. I don't like flags. I don't like the idea that we are suddenly boxed into this sense of identity through political reasons or geographical reasons. But I love people, and I love community, and I love cultural expressions of community, like the Gibraltarian expression of identity. I think it's strong. I think it's important, and I think we should protect it with our nails and with our teeth, but no, for a political, you know, purpose. I've never been into it. You know me from when I was young. I was a hippie. I was completely against, you know, violence and nations and all this nonsense that we have created to understand, to feel a bit better with the void of death. I think most of it is fear of death. So we all have to, like, you know, and bundle up in groups and fight others. no, I'm not into that, and I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to be part of any movement that like is championing flags and championing divisions and championing anti-Spanish or anti-English sentiment. I don't want that. I particularly believe in the expression of our identity as a community, and that is for me more important to, like you say, readdress our stories and like readdress our personal history of our people, apart from the wars and all that nonsense.
Yeah, a tutor I had at university once gave us very good advice. He said, never be a follower or a joiner.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's dangerous, I think, about being a follower or a fan. It shuts down your critical faculties.
Yeah, no, we learned it since we were young, even in the grunge generations. No gurus, no masters, no? That's what they sang to us. That's what John Lennon sang to us. That's what, like, Krishnamurti, when I was reading, read to us. No, it was basically, no, don't follow anyone. We don't want any trends. Yeah, we're all part of a group as writers. For example, you, myself, Mark, Jonathan, and other people. But it's not a trend. If we have dissenting ideas, we should express them. And Gibraltar is the same. Yeah, I love Gibraltar. I love my sense of Gibraltarians, but there's a lot of Gibraltarians that I don't like. And there's a lot of things about Gibraltar that are disgusting, like they are about England, like they are about Spain, like they are about Portugal, everywhere. We can't forget that we are a microcosm, but all that is marvelous about Gibraltar, the same things are horrible, because in a microcosm, everything is magnified.
Mm-hmm.
No? So yeah. We can have incredible attributes to our community, and we also have incredible defects because everything's magnetized. We are a country of 30,000 people. It's bound to implode in some way, no? So we have to be very careful, and we have to be self-critical also as poets. I don't know what you think, but I believe it's very important to be self-critical, to say, how are we writing perhaps too specifically? Maybe are we using the language as an excuse for our insecurities? We always have to be very careful with our own selves as well, no? Not to fall into this self-aggrandizing idea that because we are writing in Janito or Gibraltarian, we're doing a marvelous thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
No, of course. I mean, I think every artist has to be completely racked by self-doubt all the time. The moment you aren't, you know, even if you won the Nobel Prize, the next day you should wake up and think, what I'm doing is worthless. You know, and you always think your latest work is your worst work. That's I think that's the way it should be. It's probably healthy that way. Anything else is quite dangerous. No one has the answers. Everyone is fumbling around in the dark, I think, with the lights off. So, Gabriel, wrapping up these reflections we've had to a more prosaic sort of issue now, which is, what have you been doing recently and what have you got planned for the future? I see you've been in Ireland recently.
Yes, I've been in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland. We've toured the north of England as well. We've been to Sheffield, we've been to Hull, we've been to Doncaster. Basically, my life has become like a bit of the story that I thought other people lived, which is the idea of being a troubadour, of moving around and sharing songs for bread and wine, basically, for bread, wine, accommodation, and a bit of money to pay the debts. And yeah, it's been fantastic. It's been very exciting to see the reaction of people. And also I know that I was made cultural ambassador, but I didn't even know what the term meant. But now I realize that everywhere I go, in a way, I'm kind of showing a bit of Gibraltar to people, because what I do is very entwined, no, with the idea of finding my own identity as a Gibraltarian. So every time I play, people are asking me, like, where did this come from? And I try to explain Gibraltar and the mix of languages and the mix of ideas and the different poetry. So yeah, I'm basically just going around the UK. I'm going to Wales as well, Scotland, England, and just sharing my songs and my story and seeing how it goes. Got a new album, as you know, out in this month, the 9th of September, it came out. It's had really nice reviews online and some good music magazines. Been played in national radio, so I can't complain.
Fantastic. It seems finally be coming together.
Yes, at last, after years and years of complete, but it never really comes together, does it? It's always a process. But yeah, definitely more people are listening to it, which is which is fantastic to know.
That's fantastic, Gabriel. Well, I'm sure listeners will be looking out for your new songs and tour dates, and hopefully when you next come, you're in Jib soon in the next few months?
Yeah, in Jib, I'm November the 11th. We're doing a show in John McIntosh Hall of Poetry and Music, where myself, Adrian Pizzarello, and some poets are going to gather and try and express Gibraltarian identity through poetry and song.
That's fantastic. So if you want to pop down to that, that's in November in the John McIntosh Hall.